From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. In the 1960s, Carl Fleming covered some of the most intense battles of the civil rights movement, including the murder of three civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi. While reporting for Newsweek, he was threatened and even shot at by segregationist whites who resented his presence. Later, covering the Watts riot in Los Angeles, Fleming was attacked by a crowd and beaten nearly to death. On today's Fresh Air, Carl Fleming tells us about growing up in rural Southern poverty and why that drove him to cover the civil rights movement with such passion. His new book is Son of the Rough South, an uncivil memoir. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews Specimen Days by Michael Cunningham, and we'll listen to the music of the Beau Brummels. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davey, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest, journalist Carl Fleming, spent the early 1960s covering the most intense battles of the civil rights movement in the South for Newsweek magazine, often facing surveillance, threats, and violence from hostile whites. Some of his most harrowing moments came while investigating the murder of three civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi, a crime which returned to the news recently when an 80-year-old former Klansman, Edgar Ray Killen, was convicted of plotting the murders. After his travels in the South, Fleming headed to the magazine's Los Angeles bureau, only to find himself in the middle of the Watts riot, where he was beaten nearly to death. Although segregationist whites always regarded Fleming as a meddling outsider, he in fact was a native Southerner who was born in rural poverty and raised in an orphanage. Fleming tells his story in a new memoir called Son of the Rough South. I asked him to begin by reading a passage from the book.
In general, I felt safer in crowds than alone. I believed I could bluff and brazen myself out of danger in a crowd. I could talk and look just as tough as the bigots did. Except for the suit, clean-shaven cheeks, and evidence of a recent bath, I looked more or less like one of them, a crew-cut, 210-pound, belligerent, profane, reckless, cigar-smoking, hard-drinking, drawling redneck. I could talk the cracker talk and walk the plowboy walk. I could sip martinis from long-stemmed crystal and eat caviar and souffles in the palm court at the plaza, and I could gulp slits out of an icy bottle and eat pickled pig's feet in a backroads beer joint with a naked woman on a calendar on the wall. I could talk about my opposition to capital punishment and to hunting and invite someone into an alley behind a bar to settle an argument with fist.
Well, Carl Fleming, welcome to Fresh Air. Good to have you.
Glad to be here.
The Watts riot in Los Angeles in 1966 marked a real turning point in your life, and you happened to be there covering this after you'd spent many years covering civil rights struggles in the South, facing some pretty dangerous situations there. Remind us what touched this disturbance off.
What touched off the first big Watts riot was the arrest of a black man named Marquette Fry on a traffic violation. And his mother came out. A big argument started. Suddenly, rocks began flying, and the whole thing just exploded. And what was ignited was a deep-seated, simmering black anger that had been there, and all it needed was a match to touch it off. And it set off, of course, a riot that lasted for an entire week with 33 people killed and hundreds of millions of dollars in property damage.
Well, you were talking about the first Watts riot. I mean, it was the second one at which you got into trouble, right?
Indeed.
And what touched that disturbance off?
What touched off the riot that I was almost killed in was the killing of a black man who was driving his wife to the hospital. She was pregnant. He had tied a white handkerchief around the radio antenna of his car, which in his native Georgia was the signal of an emergency. But the police person who was chasing him obviously didn't know this, and the police person finally got him over to the curb, and the next thing you knew, the cop shot him dead while he sat beside his pregnant wife. And that was what set off the demonstrations and the riot in which I was almost killed.
Now, in the moments and days following this police shooting, there were demonstrations and there were African-American leaders who were protesting this and exhorting crowds to protest this act and protest police brutality. You've noted that when you covered the civil rights movements in the South, black leaders there tended to regard you as an ally, or at least welcomed the attention that a reporter would bring to their struggle. What was the attitude that you encountered among black nationalist leaders in Watts when you covered those events?
I had known down South Stokely Carmichael very well, had worked with him on many occasions. And if not a friend, he was certainly someone I knew who, or at least I thought, respected what I did and my work. And we had a friendly, open relationship. Suddenly he appeared at Will Rogers Park in Watts following this shooting. and got up to protest the shooting and said everybody should march down to City Hall and demand that these cops be brought to justice. And then he looked directly at me. I was standing at the back of the crowd, the only white person there. And he said, "And we ought to start charging these white reporters who come down here and exploit us and never report anything but the bad news and never report anything positive." And these young black people turned and glared to me, and I thought, I got to get out of this place. He was quite black nationalistic at that point, and in fact had been one of the leaders in driving all the white people out of the civil rights movement. So he had his own kind of views about white people's place, which was no place in the civil rights movement. And so he was tough enough and hard enough so that he could, I suppose, look me squarely in the face at that place and say, I was part of the enemy. I was part of the problem and not part of the solution.
So events got out of hand when this protest eventually ended in someone, I guess, throwing a brick through a store window, right? And then things erupted. What happened then? What do you recall about what happened then?
I recall that the tension and anger of this crowd just kept building and building and building and building. And there came a moment which I clearly recognized, a kind of an electric feeling in the air, which I had felt on other occasions covering the civil rights movement. Almost that kind of moment that comes just before a big thunderstorm explodes. And suddenly, someone threw a brick through a liquor store window, and I immediately knew something bad was going to happen. I raced back to my car. I put the camera in the trunk of my car, knowing it was a lightning rod. And as I was walking back, suddenly it was lights out. And I woke up, or I came slowly back to consciousness, numb all over, looking up into these angry black faces, seeing my blood running along the street, my reporter's notebook at my hand, bloody, blood on my shirt. And I thought, don't let it be like this. I had fantasized my death before as being taking place down south, probably in the face of some Klan mob or dragged out of my motel room at night, which was always a likelihood, and hoping that I would be able to face whatever enemy it was, like Horatio at the bridge. And suddenly here I was lying ignominiously on the pavement, hit and almost killed by black people who I had always thought were my friends. So it was quite an emotional shock because these people had no idea who I was and my background and my involvement in the civil rights movement, although I didn't think I deserved any particular credit for that. But certainly I did not think of myself as being an enemy of black people by any means. But to their minds, I was. I was just another symbol of white oppression and racism.
What injuries did you sustain in the attack?
I had two broken jaws, a fractured skull, spinal cord injury, lots of cuts and bruises where people had tried to stomp me to death. And the lingering after effect also included a severe upheaval of really, really serious asthma. Whether or not this was brought on by the emotional experience or just jarred something loose in my brain that triggered the asthma, I have no idea. I was also left with the souvenir being a permanent limp, which I have to this day.
The attack got an awful lot of attention. I mean, people wanted to interview you. What did you say about your attitude toward your attackers and this incident?
My picture was in newspapers all over the country, and it was also on television. I had a somewhat of a reputation in journalism because of my background in civil rights, and I think people undoubtedly knew my personal feelings, which is to say that I was clearly on the side of underdogs in this long-simmering dispute, but that I had always been a fair and objective reporter. Nevertheless, reporters came to the hospital to question me almost in the spirit of, well, okay, Mr. Liberal Reporter, now what do you think about these black people who beat you up? And what I said was that had I been a young black man growing up on the streets of Watts, knowing what I did about how their lives had come to that point, knowing the poverty, knowing the lack of education, knowing the split up of the families, knowing the anger toward police suppression, humiliating them at every possible turn, I probably would have had enough anger in me to want to hit some white guy over the head as well, although I would certainly not have done that. I could at least understand the anger.
Do you feel any differently today?
I do not. I jokingly say to people that being attacked in that manner made me an even more devoted advocate of Martin Luther King's position of nonviolence. But in fact, I do understand the anger. And I also say in this book that I understood, finally, some of the anger that caused the white racism. The white racism wasn't just about race. I had an incident. I was up at Oxford, Ohio, with these kids who were training to go down to Mississippi for Freedom, Mississippi Freedom Summer. And James Forman, the chairman of SNCC at that time, asked me if I would role play a white cop. And he put one of these white Jewish kids in front of me. And I started berating him and calling him boy and doing all the stuff that I had heard white people do to black people down south. And all of a sudden, I felt this anger start to rise in me. I was really steamed up and angry and really deep into this, and I was absolutely shocked. Where did this come from? And then I remembered that I had been bullied growing up in this orphanage in North Carolina, and I had this huge anger about being bullied. And so I was carrying a lot of anger. And out of that came an understanding of where some of the white racism came from poverty, lack of education, a feeling of impotence, of not being able to get a proper job, of being put down, of being irrelevant in society, so that the racism, so-called, wasn't always just about racism. And I came to understand that, though certainly not to approve it, nor did I ever condone it. At least I came to some understanding about it.
I want to talk some more about your background and your childhood, one other thing before we leave the Watts experience. You mentioned that you'd had an encounter at the beginning of the day at which you were beaten with Stokely Carmichael, the black nationalist leader. I wonder, did you ever talk to Stokely Carmichael after that about the events of that day?
Well, I, in fact, some years later, I met Stokely at a fundraising. He had by then moved to Africa and was back in this country doing some kind of fundraising thing. And we embraced, actually. And I have a picture on my wall of us with our arms around each other. And I said to him, I said, "Stokely, you SOB, you damn near got me killed." And he just kind of laughed and said, "Well, those were bad days, weren't they?" And I said, "Well, yes, they were. And these are better days, aren't they?" And he said, "Yes, they are."
My guest is Carl Fleming. His new book is Son of the Rough South, an Uncivil Memoir. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Carl Fleming. He covered the civil rights movement in the South for Newsweek magazine and was later injured in the Watts riot in Los Angeles. He has a new book called Son of the Rough South, an Uncivil Memoir. Carl Fleming, you've written that your sympathetic coverage of the civil rights movement in the South was rooted in part in your sympathy for the underdog, which grew out of the poverty you knew as a child growing up in the South. Your father died soon after you were born. What kind of living did your mother make? Give us a sense of some of the conditions that you and your sister lived in your early years.
I was born just at the tail end of the Great Depression, and after my father died when I was 5 months old, my mother tried to sell dishes and Bibles door to door and do other things to make a living, and she just couldn't make it. And finally, out of desperation, she married my father's best friend, a man she clearly did not love. He was much older, too, like my father had been. And then I had a half-sister born, but then my stepfather soon died. And my mother's health was failing. We were living in a shotgun shack down in the swamps of Eastern Carolina, a shack owned by my stepfather's family. But she just got worse and worse and worse and worse, and finally had no option except to take the advice of some of her friends in the little Methodist church in that small town and made arrangements for me to go off to the Methodist orphanage in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Before you went to the orphanage, I mean, you describe a poverty-stricken and isolated life. I mean, you really didn't have friends. Give us what did you eat? What did you wear? How did you spend your day?
We lived completely isolated on an unpaved dirt road with not even any mail delivery at that time. The only books I ever remember seeing were my mother's Bible and the annual Sears Roebuck catalog. We tended a vegetable garden. We had some chickens, which were donated by my stepfather's brother. And I walked up a country road every night to my one of my stepfather's brothers and got a pail of milk and walked it back home at night. And we ate what all poor people of that day ate. We ate more or less what we raised. The only thing that people bought were flour and sugar. And we got those donated by the local church. I wore overalls, and I don't remember, and I went barefoot, except in winter when I had one pair of shoes. I just don't remember there being any money at all. We never had a Christmas tree. We never had a Christmas celebration. We never had birthdays. But not that we were any worse off than other poor people who lived around there. It was just a desperately poor time.
You went to the orphanage and described being despondently sad about it for a time, but eventually came to regard it as your, you know, your community, your family, and it seems you grew up in a world where the rules were set by kids and your institutional caretakers, and eventually you said to think of your mother less and less. And I'm wondering, looking back, kind of what the psychological impact you think was of sort of living in that world without a parent.
My having been a kind of mama's boy added to the fact that going to this orphanage was truly a traumatic event, and I lapsed immediately into despair. I wouldn't eat. I wouldn't tie my shoes. My first nickname was Slouchy. I began to lose weight. And I was bullied. There was a kid there named Fatty Clark, and my second nickname was Pretty Boy, so Fatty Clark beat me up every day. And there was really no one to turn to. Part of the code of conduct was that you didn't squeal on anybody. You learned to survive. And if you didn't learn to survive, then you didn't make it. So I gradually learned to survive and to fit in, and I ceased being called Slouchy and being called Pretty Boy. My name became Carl Payne. That's my middle name, Carl Payne, and I was called that thereafter. And gradually I got used to being there and joined in the games and the fun. And I had terribly ambivalent feelings about my mother, which I didn't understand at the time. But psychologically, I had been given away by her, so that whenever I saw her, rare moments when I saw her, I felt intensely uncomfortable. And I came finally to a time when ever she came to visit me, I just wanted to run away. I didn't want to be around her. She also, God love her, she had many fine qualities. For one thing, she was not a racist. But on the other hand, she was extremely narcissistic and self-involved, and she always painted this orphanage experience as the great tragedy of her life, how horrible it was that she had had to give up her two children, never any recognition of all at all of how it must have felt for us. So I had very, very mixed feelings about my mother, which grew into a great amount of guilt, by the way, because she painted herself as being such a pure, loving, good, honest person, and I didn't love her, and I knew I was supposed to love her. A child's supposed to love his mother, so I felt guilty about that.
My guest is journalist Carl Fleming. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, which include Everything You've Been Taught Is Wrong by James Lowen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants both to promote international understanding and address the root causes of global poverty. Online at Hewlett.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with civil rights reporter Carl Fleming. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel from the Pulitzer Prize winner Michael Cunningham. And there's a new 4-CD retrospective of the 60s band The Beau Brummels. Ken Tucker has a review. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest, journalist Carl Fleming, covered the battles of the civil rights movement in the early 60s and was later severely beaten in the Watts riot in Los Angeles. His memoir about growing up in a southern orphanage and covering social change is called Son of the Rough South, an uncivil memoir. You joined the Navy at the end of World War II and eventually made your way into the lower rungs of the journalism profession, working at the Daily Times of Wilson, North Carolina, where your mother lived, and eventually kind of found your way into covering the civil rights movement. And I'm curious, as a white guy who had grown up in a segregated world in the South, I mean, it's interesting to me to look at what attitudes you brought to this. I mean, so many people in the South, in the early 60s would have regarded sharing, you know, drinking fountains and restrooms with black people as just completely preposterously unthinkable. What attitudes towards black people did you bring to your early years?
By all rights, given where I came from, how I grew up, who I grew up with, I probably should have grown up burning crosses on people's lawns, or worse. But because of my own experiences in this orphanage of being bullied, and because of the few good things my mother did give me, I had a sense of fair play, a strongly developed sense of not liking bullies, of abhorring the misuse of power, of the strong taking advantage of the weak. So that after growing up in the isolated atmosphere of this all-white orphanage, when I began to see racism in its expressed forms, I immediately was deeply offended and immediately took the side of the underdogs. And I felt like, you know, this is not fair. This is not right.
You became involved in covering a lot of the major civil rights battles throughout the South. And it's interesting that this is not so long ago in historical terms, but it's easy, I think, for people who see modern-day demonstrations in American cities to take for granted an atmosphere in which the worst that thing they're going to risk is arrest or being tear-gassed or maybe hit with a billy club in the extreme circumstance. But the kinds of struggles that you witnessed had a level of violence which is shocking to reread, I have to say. And you were there when James Meredith was finally admitted with the protection of federal marshals to the University of Mississippi. I'd like you to describe the scene you witnessed. They brought him in on a Sunday night to avoid a mob unsuccessfully. Describe the scene that you observed that night.
Meredith was brought onto the campus on Sunday afternoon with the view that the campus would not be occupied. But the governor, Ross Barnett, had put out a call for all Christian white Southerners to come and help defend Mississippi against the cruel barbarism of the federal government and the hated Kennedys. So the word got out that he was coming, and this huge white mob formed at the edge of the campus and began throwing rocks and bottles and Molotov cocktails at the U.S. Marshals who were there to protect Meredith. And this huge riot ensued that went on all night long. Cars overturned and set on fire, gunfire. I had myself four bullets stitched up alongside my head as I stood in front of the administration building there where the deputy U.S. marshals were holed up. And it was a horrifying thing to watch. And one of the worst things that I saw that night was I stood and watched and counted as 68 Mississippi State Highway Patrol cars slowly drove off the campus and left the scene to the rabble. In other words, they abdicated their responsibilities, as indeed the entire white leadership of that state, and just left it to the mob.
And so we weren't talking just about fists or sticks here. There was gunfire. I mean, what were the casualties that night?
Two people were killed, including one reporter shot in the back. 38 deputy U.S. marshals were wounded. Another reporter for the Washington Post was shot in the leg. It was a horrifying thing to behold. It was so chilling. They just screamed, "Give us the nigger! Hooray for old Ross! Down with the Kennedys! Kill the nigger!" And these cries went on. It was just absolute madness and bedlam all night long. And I just stood there watching and total shame and revulsion and anger. Many people have asked me, was I afraid? And I rarely was afraid. And I think the reason I was not afraid was that I was so angry and ashamed. The anger and the shame overrode whatever feelings of fear that I might have felt.
And, of course, the outcome was that despite that, the brutality of that night, Meredith remained and attended classes at Ole Miss.
Meredith went on to graduate from that school. I went to visit him many times. We would walk across the campus, and white kids would run up behind him and throw cherry bombs on the sidewalk. They would go off like gunfire. He never flinched. He was absolutely one of the bravest people I ever saw in my life.
My guest is Carl Fleming. His new memoir is called Son of the Rough South. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Speaking with author Carl Fleming, his new book is Son of the Rough South, an uncivil memoir. You spent several years in the 60s traveling through rural areas of the South, covering civil rights battles in a lot of small towns, staying at small town hotels. What were some of the steps that you had to take for your own safety?
I was followed. I had my phone tapped. I was threatened. I was beat up. I was shot at. I had my stories sabotaged at Western Union. So I traveled as much as I could with my friend Claude Sitton of the New York Times. We were not competing. So we traveled together not only because we liked each other, but also for security, because it would not do to be caught out alone on a road in the South by yourself at night. We stayed in adjoining motel rooms. We made sure that we stayed at the very front of the motel in a well-lit place, because we feared if we were at the back, we might be dragged out of our rooms with God knows what result. We used pay telephones. We never were out on back country roads at night if we could possibly avoid it, and certainly we never drove those roads alone. We finally devised a notebook, which was a cut-down secretarial-size notebook that we used to carry, big secretarial notebooks, but we thought that these were one of the things that helped people identify us as reporters, so we had one cut down that would fit into your back pocket or your jacket pocket in the hope, which turned out to be false, that we would not be identified as reporters. We were often mistaken for FBI agents because you know, we wore the Brooks Brothers suits and the button-down shirts and the rep ties and the cordovan shoes, which was how the FBI agents. And I was often accused of being an FBI agent. I must say, I never denied it. I just said, I don't want to talk about that.
Wouldn't hurt if people thought you were a federal law enforcement official.
Would not hurt.
You describe one moment, one night when you were staying at a motel with your friend Claude Sitton of the New York Times, and you heard a loud pounding at your door and looked out the window and saw a black woman in a dress begging you to please open the door. How did you react?
Well, I came awake to this terrible pounding on the door, and I lay there just terrified because I thought, this is it. This is the night they've come for us. All of a sudden, my friend Claude Sitton came running through the door, hair flying in his boxer shorts, and said, don't open the door. And I said, I'm not about to open the goddamn door. You think I'm nuts? So I climbed up and looked out the window, and there was this black woman pounding on the door, yelling, let me in. Well, my immediate thought and Claude's immediate thought was that this was a setup, that I would let the black woman in, and then we would be arrested and charged with the rape and put in jail and maybe even dragged off and killed. So, of course, I didn't open the door. And finally, she wandered off, and who she was or what she was up to, we never knew.
A recent case that's gotten so much attention in the news media is the trial of an 80-year-old former Ku Klux Klanman, Edgar Ray Killen, who I guess bears the nickname Preacher, for the deaths of three young civil rights workers in Philadelphia, Mississippi. That was, I guess, from the Freedom Summer, the activities that you covered. And you back at the time when these three civil rights workers actually disappeared, were one of the first couple of reporters to go into Neshoba County where this happened and investigate. Tell us what experiences you had with local law enforcement and citizens as you went to investigate the disappearance of these three gentlemen.
My friend Claude Sitton and I were the first two reporters to show up at the sheriff's office after these three kids went missing. And, of course, we strongly suspected that they had been killed. They had constructed a system They were supposed to call in every hour if they were away from the main office in Meridian, Mississippi, and they didn't call in. And we were immediately alerted and drove over to the sheriff's office and questioned Sheriff Rainey and Deputy Price. And they had the guilt written all over them. They took us over to the jail and showed us the books that indeed they had had these kids under arrest, but they showed us the book that they had been released, and they claimed they had taken them out to the edge of town and turned them loose. We went back the next morning, and after we finished talking to the sheriff and his deputy, we came out into the small lobby of the courthouse and were confronted by this huge mob of white guys whose leader immediately began assaulting us verbally. And he said, "If it weren't for you goddamn Jew-loving, nigger-loving communist reporters coming down here stirring up this trouble, we wouldn't be having all this difficulty," and blah, 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 and on he went. And the end of this was, "And if you don't get out of this town right now, you're going to be killed."
I was also struck by an encounter you had with four white gentlemen who appeared outside your motel room door. Tell us about that incident.
Well, after the confrontation with the white mob, we went back to our motel, and I looked out the window and saw this automobile sitting in front of our motel door with both doors flung open, and there were these four white guys sitting there. Two shotguns were visible. They had a quart of moonshine whiskey. So I went out, and they invited me to have a drink with them, which I did, and I told them I was just a good old Southern boy down there doing my job, not trying to cause any trouble, just reporting the facts. And they said, "Well, you know, we got some good farms around here. Maybe you and your buddy would like to take a ride out with us through the country." And I went back and told Claude, "We got to get out of this place." So we got in our automobile. It was raining. It was getting dark. And we took off the 35 miles for Meridian with these guys pursuing us, and they pursued us all the way to the county line, and we were more than glad to get the hell away from them, I assure you.
You've lived in California for decades, but you were a son of the South and returned to North Carolina and even to Philadelphia, Mississippi. And I'm wondering, when you see what the social changes that have come there, what insights or lessons do you draw about the strengths or limits of American democracy?
I remain an optimist about our democracy. I saw a time when I saw things so horrible that it would make me go back to my motel room and literally throw up. I went back to the South recently. The change is absolutely extraordinary. I saw terrible things, but I also saw something quite inspiring. About 100 kids, mostly black, a few Jewish, and Martin Luther King literally changed this country. And what they did in the civil rights movement gave birth to the anti-war movement, the women's movement, and the gay rights movement, so that today more people have more rights in this country than ever before. So we have a lot to be grateful for, though much remains to be done.
Carl Fleming lives in Los Angeles with his wife, journalist and novelist Ann Taylor Fleming. His memoir is Son of the Rough South, an uncivil memoir. The Beau Brummels were an American 60s British invasion-era pop group that hailed from California. They had only a few major hits, but rock critic Ken Tucker says a new four-disc retrospective of the band, called Magic Hollow, gives the band its due and then some. Here's the Beau Brummels' biggest hit from 1964, it's Laugh Laugh.
Preaching to you, I said, don't trust them, baby. Now you know you don't learn everything there is to know at school. Wouldn't believe me when I get.
That's the Beau Brummels' only top 10 hit, Laugh Laugh, sung by a 20-year-old Sal Valentino in his distinctive quavering tenor, and produced by Sly Stewart, who would later lead Sly and the Family Stone. The real brains behind the Beau Brummels, however, was songwriter-guitarist Ron Elliott, who wrote all of the band's best songs and despite the fact that the Bo Brummels quickly became something less than a cult band, had admirers ranging from the Everly Brothers to Otis Redding to Randy Newman. Elliot was a real music nerd, a child prodigy on guitar diagnosed as a diabetic. He claimed that melodies, quote, poured out of him. His medical condition occasionally kept him off the road, and from fully enjoying his band's brief, girls-screeching popularity in the late 60s, with their follow-up semi-hits like Just a Little, You Tell Me Why, and Don't Talk to Strangers. Elliot frequently claimed not to even like much rock and roll. He was fond of the musical theater and toyed with the idea of writing a suite of madrigals about his favorite books. You guessed it, the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Despite such flightiness, Elliot sure knew how to bend a pop hook into something irresistible. And in his pal Sal Valentino, he had an ideal voice to deliver the Bo Brummels' sinuous melancholy.
You tell me that I should not cry. You tell me all good things must die. You ask me why I get upset. You tell me that I will forget. Tell me why.
It's really striking what a fully formed talent Elliot and Valentino had right from the start. It's almost shocking to hear this song, a piece of beautiful bitterness called People Are Cruel, and discover that it's a never-released tune cut during one of the band's earliest ventures into a recording studio. This four-disc, 113-song retrospective is one of those labors of love that includes unreleased tracks as well as the meticulous liner notes from which I've cribbed the biographical details I'm recounting here. The project's producers buy into the idea that as Elliot's ambitions matured, their lack of commercial success amounts to a tragedy. But to my ears, that gets the importance of the band's music backward. Their 1967 album Triangle, freighted with the repeated symbolism that turned on the band's becoming a trio, and Elliot's seeing great importance in the number 3, came perilously close to stuffy art rock. In 1968, they released what many of their fans consider their greatest work, Bradley's Barn. The idea was to ship the Brummels down to Nashville, hook them up with many of the same crack session players that appeared on Bob Dylan's Nashville Skyline, and presto, Ron Elliott's songs would take on a country rock grandeur. Instead, the album was, I'm afraid, deeply, draggingly self-conscious. More Bo Bummer than Brummel.
Coyote hunts his frightened meal. The moon splits on the broken wheel. She don't know about the way she feels. Cherokee girl. Coyote hunts on winter ground. He tries to track a shadow.
I remain a big Bo Brummels fan, and I urge you to listen to Magic Hollow for the idiosyncratic take on harmony and British invasion pop that these bright West Coast lads were able to produce early in their career. It's the Bo Brummels who appeared on teen TV dance shows like Hollywood A-Go-Go and Where the Action Is, who became animated characters in an episode of The Flintstones that I think are everlastingly swell. They were never naive, silly boys, though Ron Elliott was able to write and Sal Valentino was able to sing music that captured the kind of heartache that naive, silly boys and girls everywhere, of all ages, could latch onto and take solace in.
Ken Tucker is film critic for New York Magazine and Fresh Air Rock Critic. He reviewed Magic Hollow, a new retrospective set from the Beau Brummels. Coming up, the new novel from Pulitzer Prize winner Michael Cunningham. This is Fresh Air. Michael Cunningham's novel The Hours was his breakthrough book. It not only garnered serious literary awards, it was also made into an Academy Award-winning movie starring Nicole Kidman. Cunningham's much-awaited new novel, Specimen Days, has just been published, and book critic Maureen Corrigan says it's an intriguing disappointment.
Michael Cunningham is hip enough to know that his latest novel, Specimen Days, has the day-old smell of a sequel about it. Like his bestseller, The Hours, Specimen Days is composed of three interlocking tales graced by the unifying presence of a literary muse. In interviews, Cunningham has deflected criticism about cashing in on a successful formula by wittily protesting that the two novels really couldn't be more dissimilar. In The Hours, the muse was Virginia Woolf. In Specimen Days, Walt Whitman is the presiding spirit. Let me suggest another difference between the two books. The Hours is a superb novel. Specimen Days, only a middling one. The Hours managed to pay explicit homage to Woolf's novel Mrs. Dalloway, while also unmooring itself from that progenitor. Specimen Days feels more derivative, not so much of Whitman's masterwork Leaves of Grass, but of itself. The novel essentially retells the same doomed love story via three different genres. The first tale, called In the Machine, is a work of straightforward literary fiction. Set in late 19th century New York, it follows a few days in the life of a misshapen 13-year-old boy named Lucas, the son of Irish immigrants, who's bizarrely memorized chunks of Whitman's poetry. Obliged to take his dead brother's place at a factory where no one can be bothered to tell him what he's making, Lucas pines for his dead brother's fiancée. The Children's Crusade, the second tale, morphs into a noir. A police psychologist named Kat, working in post-9/11 New York, races against the clock to identify a band of child suicide bombers who distinguish themselves by quoting Whitman. Kat succumbs to an obsession with one of the terrorists. The final tale, like Beauty, is futuristic sci-fi. New York has now deteriorated into a theme park where humanoid robots stage muggings for the amusement of foreign tourists. One robot escapes New York land with the improbable object of his desire, a 4.5-foot-tall green lizard from another planet. Perhaps through this triptych on misbegotten loves in Gotham, Cunningham is trying to mimic Whitman's own obsessive rewritings of Leaves of Grass. But the narrative costume changes here only succeed in giving Specimen Days an artificial quality, as though Cunningham were assigning himself a creative writing exercise in mastering the art of genre. And yet, to dismiss Specimen Days outright wouldn't be fair, because as always with Cunningham, there's the evocative power of his language. On every page of this novel, despite its contrivances, there's something genuine. A space where we readers are whisked deep into perceptions, feelings, and worlds removed from our own. Take Lucas's vision of what the men he works with at the factory have really exchanged in payment for their labors. Lucas began to see that the days at the works were so long, so entirely composed of the one act performed over and over and over again, that they made of themselves a world within the world, and that those who lived in that world, all the men of the works, lived primarily there and paid brief visits to the other world, where they ate and rested and made ready to return again. Specimen Days is filled with similar images of urban bleakness as well as paranoia. "Why exactly do you think we shouldn't be nervous all the time?" asks one New York robot to another in like beauty. Despite its disappointments, Specimen Days has about it the quiver of big city energy and anxiety at a moment when, once again, our fear of anonymous others holds sway. Writing about New York post 9/11, Cunningham lacks Whitman's egalitarian empathy, his joyous embrace of the anonymous masses. Even his 19th century story is infused with a retrospective skittishness. But at the same time, Cunningham recognizes that the city is still the only place where his unlikely couples could run into each other. His characters step into the street, elbows out, eyes darting in all directions. But nonetheless, they think it worthwhile to risk the unplanned, touch the unlike, ride the jostle of democracy and desire.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Specimen Days by Michael Cunningham. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Stu Swolen directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Charles Stuart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And from TIAA CREF, serving those who serve others by offering financial services for the greater good, TIAA-CREF.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Pac-Man to Grand Theft Auto, writer Steven Johnson contends video games have become more challenging and complex and are actually making our kids smarter. He even thinks television is sharpening our minds. On the next Fresh Air, he explains why everything bad is good for you. Join us for the next Fresh Air.